American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
American Timelines by History for Jokes, the greatest podcast ever.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time.
How come when you sing it doesn't sound anything like that?
Because I can't sing and Matt Truman can.
That's
I don't have the prowess. The moxie.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines. I'm Amy.
At the time of your life. And I'm Cagle Phillips.
What?
Cagle Phillips. I am one of the Phillips sisters. I was named after a Kegel.
You are a girl?
A Kegel exercise. I am a lady.
You've got a beautiful voice.
I'm a beautiful lady with a beautiful voice. And I was named after a Kegel.
All right.
Which is a vaginal exercise. Did you know that?
And this is the podcast that brings you... Stop it. This is the podcast that brings you all of the pop culture facts from the past, and we do it year by year.
Facts. Not F-A-X, like the transmitting paper documents, but facts, factoids,
and
truths.
Tonight, we are discussing 1975.
Postulates and theorems, baby. And my name is Joe.
1975.
It's 1975. Yeah, this is the last episode. We're going to wrap up 75 here. We've spent a lot of time marinating in it like the stinky onions of a delicious slumgullion.
Okay. All right, what's the first item up for bid?
Oh, you don't want to talk about our podcast and explain it anymore?
No,
oh.
Because either you listen or you don't.
Oh, boom. And we're giving up on new listeners. If you're a new listener, just turn off the podcast now. If you're
No, we're not saying that.
Just kidding. No, go back to episode like 26 and start there. You'll get it from there.
Yeah.
We're in August. We left off in August with the Eagles, I think, were on the number one spot on the Billboard charts.
Okay.
One of These Nights. Did we talk about that last episode? We might
one
not have.
One of These Nights. I don't think we did.
It was written by, guess if it was written by Don Henley or Glenn Frey?
Glenn Frey.
Wrong, both. Boom.
That wasn't an option. You dick.
Oh, I am a dick. This song was a conscious attempt by the band to write something different from a country rock and ballad type song. Don Henley said, "We like to be a nice little country rock band for
that is not what he said.
About half the time."
That's not how he talks.
Maybe that's how he talks. Don Henley. Okay, sorry. Don Henley said, "We like That's my Don Henley.
You're editorializing.
Right, here's my Don Henley impression. Brains.
Okay, we're not going to listen to it.
Okay. Anyway, he liked to be a nice country rock band from Los Angeles about half the time. He added, "We wanted to get away from the ballad syndrome with One of These Nights. With Don Felder in the band now, we can really rock." Fry said that they wanted One of These Nights to have a lot of teeth, a lot of bite, a nasty track with pretty vocals.
I don't know if I'd say it has a lot of teeth and a lot of bite.
You would say that's a nasty song?
No,
nasty,
I wouldn't say One of These Nights is a nasty song.
One of These Nights, is that how it goes?
One of these crazy old nights.
Laughter in the rain.
Here it comes.
One of these, I would say that's the opposite of having teeth.
I mean, there was a guitar solo that was just starting when you turned it off.
A nasty track with pretty vocals. A nasty track, though? That's not a nasty track.
I mean,
of course, this was years before Janet Jackson showed everybody what nasty was.
I think of Prince when I think of, like, nasty.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of thing. Sexy, nasty kind of.
Sexy, nasty little Motley Crue.
Like a Prince and stuff, that kind of music.
Prince, yeah. Well, this isn't nasty at all.
No.
Then Tuesday, August 5th, the first ever DC-Marvel collaboration was for a comic.
Oh.
In 1975 called, you know what it is? You know what?
No.
Did you know that I never knew they collaborated.
Oh,
I thought Marvel and DC is like Pepsi and Coke. Like,
yeah, rivals.
They're not going to make a soda together.
That's right. That's what I thought.
Anyway, those of you big super nerds that listen and love comic books and have a big comic boner right now, go ahead and just
going
to
say.
Look to the person next to you and say what it is.
Excuse me, I believe that...
Well, it's obvious. Everybody knows at Comic-Con.
I can't believe that you don't remember that DC and Marvel did a collaboration.
Only a novice it would not know that it's the marvelous Wizard of Oz.
What?
Obviously, it was the Wizard of Oz.
Okay, what is the collaboration?
The marvelous Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz?
Yes.
It was?
Duh. What are you, a newbie?
Well, I thought you meant like
you, a beginner?
Superman was hanging out with Wolverine or something.
No,
I thought that's what you were going
to
say.
DC and Marvel made a comic book together, and they worked together to make it. And they
Who cares?
And it was a Wizard of Oz comic book about the Wizard of Oz.
I thought you meant the characters worked together.
No, I didn't say that.
Well, that's stupid then. Who cares?
Oh, jeez. You're going to have a lot of comic book. You know, you used to have these fan followers, these fanboys that love you that are comic book. Like, they have a booth ready for you at Comic-Con, like an Amy from American Timeline booth that they're all like, somebody's cosplaying as you. They just put on crazy nerd pointy 40s glasses and wear the crazy weird outfits that you wear. And but now, guess what? Canceling it. Nerds are canceling it. They now hate you. Wednesday, August 6th, 1975, when Agatha Christie killed off Detective Hercule Poirot in 1975. Did you ever hear about this? He became the only fictional character to receive a front page obituary in the New York Times.
Oh, wow. 1975 that happened?
Yeah. They printed an obit of a fictional character.
On the front page?
Yeah. A front page obit of a fictional character.
It's ridiculous. And it was New York Times that did that?
Mm-hmm.
She's a British author.
Well, it's a detective that probably everyone loved that. They must have loved Agatha Christie books, and they must have loved. She must have been a character they loved.
It must have been.
Keep in mind, everyone...
It must have been a slow news day.
And everyone was on coke.
Right. And I mean, that must have just been one day out of the whole time that nobody was murdered.
People's facial hair was dripping cocaine all the time.
Because people were murdered every 5 seconds. In the 70s.
Every adult was on crack in the 70s. all the time, the whole time.
I don't think crack existed in the 70s.
They're on cocaine mixed with...
No, they weren't. They were token.
Maple syrup. Okay, I guess it was weed then. Okay, fine. Wednesday, August 6th, 1975. That was it. Friday, August 8th, 1975. Mm-hmm. The lowest PGA score of 63 was played by Bruce Crapton.
Crapton?
Crapton. Oh, nice. Crampton. Crampton, sorry.
Oh,
I wish it was Crapton.
Damn.
Bruce Crampton set the PGA Championship 18-hole record with a 7-under 63 in the second round of the 1975 PGA Championship. Since then, 13 players have tied Crampton's mark for the best round at golf's fourth and final major of the season. And if you care about that, please stop listening to our podcast.
Yeah, really.
Please, if you've reviewed our podcast and you care about that, please erase your review.
No,
you
don't say that.
No, I guess not. No, just.
But that was so boring that I tuned out after PGA.
Yeah,
that's all I remember about that moment
in my
life.
I don't even know what I read. I didn't even listen to it after I found out.
All
it wasn't
I remember
crafted.
About that moment in my life is PGA. That's all I know.
Do you remember me saying his name was Crapton?
Yeah, I do remember that.
And then once we found out it wasn't Crapton, that
tuned out even more
so. And then the next day, we can forget about Bruce Crapton. Crap ton of crap. Stupid PGA. Golf is terrible. I'm sorry. Saturday, August 9th. I like to drink beer and play it. I'm not good at it. Okay. Saturday, August 9th, 1975. The Bee Gees take over the Billboard number one spot.
Oh.
Do you know what it is?
I can't remember. Is it?
The song. Wait, let me tell you this. The song, according to Wikipedia, song was originally called Drive Talking.
Jive talking.
Jive. It's the only word I know is jive talking.
Yeah.
The song's rhythm was modeled after the sound their car made crossing the Julia Tuttle Causeway each day from the Biscayne Bay to Criteria Studios in Miami.
Oh, so the rickety bridge.
Yep.
Okay.
And they said, drive talking. That's when they would sing. You could see these Bee Gees in their white suits and their beards singing that to each other. Jive talking.
Dude, that's so dumb.
Then they changed it to jive talking after they saw the airplane. The guys talking jive.
I don't think
you
so.
You don't speak jive? No, I don't think
Did Airplane know. Already come out?
I think it's 70.
Did we already cover that?
75. I think it comes out. Oh, no, I don't know. I don't think we did.
We didn't cover it yet. didn't think so.
Yeah, I don't think that movie really made him change it. But but then on Monday, August 18th, 1975, over 90% of...
Hello? What happened? Did you just have a stroke?
Oh, Monday, August 18th, 1975 was the San Francisco Police Department strike of 75. You ever heard about that?
No.
90% of the police department walked out for 4 days in pay dispute. The SFPD clashed with the law and the mayor.
Boom.
Eventually, a bomb was detonated on the mayor's lawn with a sign reading, "Don't threaten us."
Who did that?
The mayor threatened immediate suspension without pay for striking officers.
So that somebody in the police department did the bomb?
I guess, yeah. Somebody in
and
the
so
union.
It was them
the
versus
union probably,
the mayor?
Yeah, I guess, because he was like, "I'm going to suspend you guys all without pay." And they were like, "Don't threaten us, biatch. Here's a bomb."
Wow.
And that's when Ice Cube said, "Dropping bombs on your mom."
No.
Fuck car alarms.
It's not.
It might be. You don't know.
No, it's not.
You don't know. Saturday, August 23rd, 1975. Hamilton, Joe, Frank, and Reynolds.
Yes.
You know who that is? No. Hamilton, Joe, Frank, and Reynolds.
Wait a minute. How many people are you talking about?
Is that I must be missing a name. Hamilton, Joe, Frank.
How many people is that?
And Reynolds. That's Joe Frank is one guy, I think. Hamilton is one. Yeah, Joe Frank and Reynolds. That's the name of the group. I don't know why.
Why do we know the middle guy's
just Joe Frank
whole
is
name.
His whole name, but Hamilton.
But then the other two, it's just the
Hamilton
last
and Reynolds. I don't know. I don't
this
know.
This sounds like a story that is well researched.
Well, maybe I should have looked up the group more than the song. But Dan Hamilton was the guy who wrote it. The song's called "Fallen in Love." And the song was covered by LaBouche in 1995 on their debut album, Sweet Dreams. And sampled by Canadian rapper-singer Drake. Drake sampled it.
What's the song called?
Best I Ever Had. Fallen in Love.
You don't know this one, do you? No, I don't know this one.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard that song, and mm-mm. I don't particularly ever want to hear it again.
No kidding.
And then Saturday, August 30th. Mm-hmm. Saturday, August 30th, 1975, Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Sweet.
Band bring the world back to respectability with a good song on the number one spot.
Is it Do a Little Dance, Make a Little Love?
Get Down Tonight.
Is that it?
Yep.
Sweet.
And that song was originally titled What You Want Is What You Get.
I love Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Yeah, they're really good. And I will admit this, I feel real dumb because we watched, I don't know if you remember, there was something on YouTube where it just went through quickly all the Billboard number one songs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the first time I've ever seen them live. I didn't know Casey was a white guy.
Oh,
I thought
really?
They were all, I just thought the band was all black guys.
Nope.
I don't know why.
No, he was the only white guy, I think.
He looks like the Ultimate Warrior or something in the video we saw, like this long-haired, mullet, yeah. White guy that just doesn't fit with everybody else, but he made some funky grooves.
Yeah, they have some good ones.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know why. I didn't realize he was a white guy. Not that it matters, but that proves it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter.
Nope. He just as funky.
Although I'm less likely to like you if you're white, just so you know.
I know.
But I don't like you. No, I'm just kidding. I like you. I like you a lot. I actually love you.
Well, good.
But I don't know that you're white because I don't see race or gender or color.
I could just be the blob sitting here.
I don't see sex. I don't
have any gender
anything.
Or
yeah,
anything.
You don't have a gender. I don't
color
really,
or race, nothing.
I don't really find you attractive. No, I do find you attractive.
What? Wait a minute.
I think. I don't know. I can't tell. I can't see you. I can't see anything. Friday, September 5th, 1975. That's mainly because my eyes are going bad. I wore these glasses.
You got those poop glasses.
I got these DMC glasses on.
That's right.
Friday, poop glasses. I never did that because I won that bet. Friday, September 5th, 1975. Lynette Squeaky Fromm, a cult member of Charlie Manson's Manson family, attempted to assassinate United States President Gerald Ford in Sacramento,
right.
California.
That is right.
She wanted to make a statement to people who refuse to halt environmental pollution and its effects on air, trees, water, and animals. So that is a good cause, good reason, but not a good thing to do.
Well, good cause, but not good reason.
Not good reason. You shouldn't try to shoot
like
a president.
Like, the one thing doesn't correlate with the other,
correct.
Really.
Nobody should ever try to shoot a president.
Right.
Unless it's a president of evil.
Right. We can agree on that, I suppose.
Okay. Although Fromm stood little more than an arm's length from Ford that Friday morning and pointed an M1911 pistol. M1911, is that what you call it?
I have no idea.
I'm not a big gun guy. I only own four or five of them.
Mm-hmm.
But she pointed at him in the public grounds of the California State Capitol building. Her gun failed to fire and no one was injured. After the assassination attempt, Ford continued to walk to the California State House where he met with California Governor Jerry Brown. For her crime, Fromm spent 34 years in prison and was released.
Oh, was she?
August 14th, 2009.
I wonder what she's doing now.
2 years and 7 months after Ford's death. The Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan, later received the pistol used in the assassination attempt as a gift, and the gun was put on display.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
That is weird. I wonder if it's still on display.
Now, shouldn't she really have the rights to get it back?
I don't think so. Once you commit a crime with stuff, I think you forfeit all your rights, ownership and stuff.
So say she...
Because I can't believe it's not... I mean, it's evidence of a crime, so I'm surprised that they can just give it to a museum. I guess she's out of jail, so it doesn't matter anymore, but...
Say she tried to commit a crime with a stapler. They wouldn't give her that stapler back?
No, I don't think so.
It was a red swing line?
They can keep, like, if you...
Oh, yeah, I guess it's evidence,
if
right?
somebody stole your car and then committed murders in it or something...
Yeah, I would never get that car back.
You'll never get the car back, and you don't get compensated for that.
What about if I have my baseball cap in the back seat? Do I get my baseball cap
no,
back?
No, you don't get shit back, and you don't get compensated for it.
What if I
out.
Had my favorite sweatshirt in the back, in the
somebody
trunk?
Somebody came in and stole all four of your guns that you said you have?
You don't know.
You'll never get them back. They keep them for the evidence.
So Saturday, September 6th, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Campbell takes over the number one spot of the Billboard chart after he leaves the Eagles in a big argument. He
Glenn Campbell was not in the Eagles. You think everybody was in the Eagles?
Well, he was Glenn Fry. Glenn Fry and Glenn Campbell and Don Henley and Steve Winwood are all the same person.
What did he sing?
Rhinestone Cowboy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Like a rhinestone cowboy. Mm-hmm.
There's a video for this where he's in a cowboy suit
yep.
on a horse, just singing it.
Rodeo.
And I wish we could force him and Cher to do that one song she performed as
half-breed.
On a horse. Half-breed on a horse the whole time.
Half-breed and rhinestone cowboy yeah, as a medley.
And just like chase each other around when they're both singing that nonstop.
And that would be something.
This song enjoyed huge popularity with both country and pop audiences when it was released in 1975. In late 1974, Campbell heard the song on the radio during a tour of Australia, decided to learn the song, and soon after his return to the United States, Campbell went to Al Khoury's office at Capitol Records, where he was approached about a great new song, Rhinestone Cowboy. Several music writers noted that Campbell identified with the subject matter of Rhinestone Cowboy, survival and making it, particularly when the chips are down.
Is that what that's about?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't. All I know is...
Do you know any other words?
Rhinestone Cowboy.
I'm always making it when the chips are down.
Something in the rodeo.
Something about a rodeo yeah. when the chips are always down. Now, Thursday, September 16th, 1975. Listen to this. The CIA created a gun that could shoot darts that caused heart attacks.
Oh, whoa.
Upon penetration of the skin, the dart just left a tiny red dot. The poison itself worked rapidly and denatured.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a word? Denatured?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
The poison itself worked rapidly and denatured quickly afterwards. It was revealed in 1975 in a congressional testimony. In 1975, during the church committee hearings, the existence of a secret assassination weapon came to light. The CIA had developed a poison that caused the victim to have an immediate heart attack. The poison could be frozen into the shape of a dart.
Oh, I thought you were going to say dildo.
No. No, I wasn't going to say that. I don't know why you would think I was going to say that. This poison could
you
be
always,
frozen.
Because you always talk about things frozen in the shape of a dildo.
I've never once ever mentioned that in my entire existence. That's an appalling
all
accusation.
All kinds of different things.
And I will not sit here
you say
and listen
freeze
to this.
It in the shape of a dildo.
I've never once mentioned that ever before. This is the first time I'm hearing this accusation.
Items. There's several items
this
I can think
fake
of.
News. Fake news.
About
fake news.
Freezing things in the shape of a dildo.
This poison could be frozen into the shape of a dart and then fired at high speed from a pistol. pistol. The gun, it probably could be shaped into a dildo, too. The gun was capable of shooting the icy projectile with enough speed that
you'd
the dart...
You'd have to really aim carefully if it was shaped like a dildo, though.
The dart would go right through the clothes of the target and leave just a tiny red mark. Once in the body, the poison would melt and be absorbed into the blood and cause a heart attack. The poison was developed to be undetectable by modern autopsy procedures.
Well, I'm sure that's not gone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know. You that's, know. And because here's my thing.
Anytime politicians have a heart attack, you think,
that's what I think. Anybody famous who has a heart attack, anybody rich and famous who has a heart attack and dies.
It's kind of like,
okay, they have the best doctors in the world.
I wish somebody.
They're
oh,
not going to die.
I can't say it.
No, you can't say you wish.
You can't say
no,
it.
No, and it's what, well, you look at somebody like, this horrible monster we have that's a big, fat, unhealthy piece of crap. Of course, why isn't he having a heart attack? Because he has the best doctors in the world. Like, all these awful people that do terrible things, they have the best doctors in the world.
Right,
they're
true.
Not going to die of a heart attack.
Yeah.
So, but some people still do die of a heart attack. It's all foul play.
Every single,
single
person.
It's foul play.
That has a heart attack.
Every rich person and famous person, no matter how old they
just
are,
every
it's
person.
Foul play.
All of them.
Like when a 90-year-old dies, it's foul play.
That's right.
Abe Vigoda died of foul play. He's the best doctors ever. They can just keep you alive forever.
That's true.
You know, James Madison, the president?
He's still alive?
No. When he was dying, he was like 90 or something or 86.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the end of June. And they were like, oh, well, you're pretty much dead. But he wants to keep you alive until July 4th. Because 4th of July is when presidents are supposed to die. Because, you know, Adams and Jefferson both died on the same day. It was the 4th of July. It was 50 years after the 76.
Oh, wow.
They both died on the same day. So this was a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
And Madison was like, ugh, and they're like, we'll keep you alive till July 4th if you want. And he was like, fuck that shit. Just let me go. And he died like June 20 something. September 20th, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
David Bowie takes over the Billboard number one spot.
Do we already do fame?
No, this is it.
Fame.
I'm about to blow your mind with this. Fame. Okay. Something you didn't know about fame.
Okay.
It was written by David Bowie, Carlos Alomar, and a young man named, I don't know. Do you want to guess?
No.
John Lennon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, boom.
It's not that mind-blowing.
Really. It was a hit. Yeah, wait, just wait. It was a hit in North America, becoming Bowie's first number one single in the Canadian singles chart as well as the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. But listen to this. He was staying in New York City where he met John Lennon. The pair jammed together, leading to a one-day session at Electric Lady Studios in January 1975. There, Carlos Alomar had developed a guitar riff for Bowie's cover of Foot Stompin' by the Flares, which Bowie thought was a waste to give to a cover. Lennon, who was in the studio with him, sang fame over the, he sang the word aim over the riff. Which Bowie,
aim.
Which aim, A-I-M.
Why did he do that?
He was singing about you, aim.
No, he wasn't.
Over the riff, which Bowie turned into fame, and he therefore wrote the rest of the lyrics to the song. Lennon's voice is heard interjecting the falsetto, fame, throughout the song.
Oh, that's
him singing it, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Boom, you didn't know John Lennon sang that?
No, I didn't. It's not one of my favorites, that song.
No, it's
I don't really
not,
like that song.
Yeah, it's not that great, but it's it reminds me of Brian Anke.
Oh, really?
He's a tall guy that loves that song. He lives in New York City. So anybody who lives in New York City listening, if you see a really, really tall guy, he's like 8'7".
He's not.
Yeah, no, he is. He's definitely 8'7" or 8". And he's always singing that song loudly. So if you heard that.
There probably is somebody that's that description in New York
yeah,
City.
Yeah, a guy like that, yeah.
Yep.
Fame! Yeah. Is there never anyone know? And then Monday, September 22nd, 1975, Sarah Jane Moore, who had been evaluated by the Secret Service earlier in 1975, but agents decided that she posed no danger to the president, attempted to shoot Gerald Ford.
Yes.
The second time Gerald Ford
in
was
like a month.
In a couple months. She had been picked up by police on an illegal handgun charge the day before the Ford incident, but was released. And the police had confiscated her .44 caliber revolver and 113 rounds of ammunition. Moore's assassination attempt took place in San Francisco just 17 days after Squeaky Fromm's attempted assassination.
How many?
Of Ford. 17 days.
Not even a month.
Not even a month.
Oh, my God.
She was standing in the crowd across the street from St. Francis Hotel and was about 40 feet away from Ford when she fired a single shot at him with a .38 caliber revolver.
But there's a lot of people hating Ford.
They just want to shoot that guy. And Nixon was way worse. She was using a gun she bought in haste that same morning and did not know the sights were 6 inches off the point of impact at that distance, and she narrowly missed. After realizing she had missed, she raised her arm again, and Oliver Sipple, you know, my man Oliver Sipple, a former Marine, dived toward her and grabbed her arm, possibly saving Ford's life. Sipple said at the time, "My name rhymes with nipple. What else am I going to do?"
No, that's not what he said.
Sipple said at the time, "Yo, dude, I'm Oliver Sipple in the house.
No.
Oliver Sipple." No. Oliver Sipple said at the time, "I saw her gun pointed out there, and I grabbed for it. I lunged and grabbed the woman's arm, and the gun went off. My name rhymes with nipple."
No.
The bullet from the second shot ricocheted and hit John Ludwig, a 42-year-old taxi driver.
Oh, poor John Ludwig.
And he was like, fuck. John Ludwig said, shit.
He did.
U.S. District Judge Samuel Conte, still on the bench in 2010, spoke on the record saying that Moore would have killed Ford had she had her own gun, and it was only because her gun was faulty that the president's life was spared. She pled guilty to attempted assassination and was sentenced to life in prison. At her sentencing hearing, Moore stated, "Am I sorry I tried? Mm-hmm. Yes and no. Yes, because it accomplished little except to throw away the rest of my life. And no, I'm not sorry. Sorry, not sorry. I tried because at the time it seemed a correct expression of my anger."
So she'll never get out of jail with that attitude.
How about this? In 1979, she escaped from the Alderson Federal Prison Camp in Alderson, West Virginia. She is still on the loose.
No.
No, she's not. Oh. She was captured hours later.
Hours?
After her return, she was transferred to a more secure facility.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Friday, September 26th, 1975. Do you know what movie came out?
No.
Okay, this show has the longest running theatrical release in film history. Longest running theatrical release in film history. This is also, I was going to give it away, Tim Curry's feature film debut.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yep.
Yes. I like Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yep.
You never saw it.
I did see parts of it, and I don't get what it is. Yeah. This is, again, one of those things. I've maybe talked to this and maybe alluded to this phenomenon. It's probably got a name. I call it the Monty Python syndrome, where if you watch something that people have built up so much, you can't like it. Like, there's no way to like it, especially if you watch it with those people.
Oh, God, because they're so obnoxious, you know, about
it. Yeah, like the people, like the first time I ever saw any Monty Python, 8 people in the room were reciting every line loudly as with the lines.
Mm-hmm, that's
and
obnoxious.
And it just instantly made me hate it. I was like, this is stupid and dumb, and just it sucks if Muppet and Brendan Kane are saying all these lines, you know, or whatever it was.
You just totally.
I don't know if it was those two or not, but, you know, it's just like that. So you can't like it. So the same thing with Rocky Horror, like every time I had the opportunity to see this. It was like with 45 theater people who had a bunch of toast they were ready to throw at the screen.
Yeah, that's so dumb.
Because young people, if you don't know, people watch this movie still now, and they get all high on their drugs and their opioids, and then they go to a theater and then they throw objects all over for the poor staff to pick up afterwards. Toast and, I don't know, mugs of coffee and like those jugs of urine that truckers leave on the side of the road. They just throw those at the screen. I think
that's at least what I
assume. Yeah. So you just feel like you're left out and you're already not part of the party. So let's just stay out of the party. When Barry Boswick pounds his fist on the table during the dinner scene, he accidentally pounded on the hand of Susan Sarandon. So the reaction from Sarandon is prominent and real.
Oh, okay.
She got a revenge by cutting off Boswick's penis.
No.
No, she got revenge by accidentally stepping on Boswick's foot with her spike heel during the floor show scene. His reaction is also visible.
Okay.
Do you know those two events?
They're not.
You have to go back and watch them.
Yeah, I have to.
So, here's all the things that people throw for real. I know I said the urine. Let's see if it's in here.
Toast.
At midnight showings, they throw it at somebody's wedding. Water pistols. During a rain scene, newspapers for front and middle rows to shield themselves from the rain, flashlights or cigarette lighters for There's Light.
Yep.
There's a Light verse over at Frankenstein's place. Rubber gloves, noisemakers, toilet paper, confetti, toast, party hat, bell, cards. The props vary from city to city. There's all kinds of other stuff about doing that live. It's supposed to be great. I mean, everybody does that, loves it, and has a good time, and I'm sure it's good, clean fun.
Yeah.
Except for the staff who have to clean it all up. Although, free toast.
That's true.
Free toast. For
who doesn't love that? Yeah, cold toast.
Oh, cold toast on the floor of a movie theater? I'm all over
sounds
that.
Sounds delish.
Bring your own butter.
Yep.
BYOB, y'all. That's what that's what BYOB.
Bring your own butter.
Yeah, it was bring your own butter at after midnight showings of Rocky Horror Picture Show. Man, I'm always dropping knowledge on people. Saturday, September 27th, 1975, John Denver takes over the Billboard charts. Number one spot with...
Country Road, Take Me Home. Or did we already do that one?
I think we already did that one.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
I know we did Thank God I'm a Country Boy.
I'm sorry?
I don't know that one. It's probably a ballad. This reminds me of my Aunt Susie. You ever have that where there's somebody
no matter you hear artists, it always reminds you of the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's a John Denver ballad. It seems I was getting ready to cry, so I had to turn it off because it seems sad.
So touching.
John Denver.
His voice is kind of sad.
He is. I want him to sing me to sleep when.
He sounds like he's singing lullabies when he sings.
You know what? This is recorded, so I'm going to say this now. At my funeral, I want John Denver to be there, and I want him to sing a bunch of songs.
John Denver's dead, sweetheart.
Well, I want him resurrected at my funeral. Resurrect him, bring him back from the dead for my funeral.
You're insane.
Okay?
Insane. Promise?
Is that a promise? You have to do it.
I'm not.
You're my wife.
That.
You have to do that.
No, I'm not doing it.
All right. Seven John Denver impersonators walking around, like bugging people and making them listen to them sing.
No.
Please, seven, eight, ten.
All right.
Everybody has to dress up like John Denver at my funeral.
Okay.
Okay. Everyone has to get plastic surgery to look like John Denver.
Okay. We'll do it.
That's a great idea. Saturday, October 11th, 1975, George Carlin was the first host of Saturday Night Live when it aired the first time on October 11th, 1975. This was the only episode to date in which the host did not appear in sketches.
Well, and they...
That was his request.
He was just stand-up. Mm-hmm. Well, and they hadn't, at first, they didn't know whether they were going to just have a permanent host.
Yeah, and he wanted to be the permanent host. They wanted Richard Pryor to be the permanent host.
And then they couldn't get him. And then
Carlin did, and then he thought he was going to be the permanent host. He kind of wanted to be, because it was a new show. They're figuring it out.
Yep.
Do you know what was on Saturday nights before Saturday Night Live on NBC?
No.
From 1965 until September of 1975, NBC would just run the Best of Carson reruns of The Tonight Show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's dead air, pretty much.
Yeah. And then Johnny Carson said he wanted those weekend shows pulled and saved so that they could be aired during weeknights, allowing him to take time off.
So that makes sense.
So they're like, shit, now we got to come up with something else.
Because otherwise, God, did that man was probably
every
had a
night,
horrible
yeah.
schedule.
Tired. And then so NBC president Herbert Schlosser approached his vice president of late night programming, Dick Ebersol, and asked him to create a show to fill the Saturday night time slot. This is all according to Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
At the suggestion of Paramount Pictures executive Barry Diller, Schlosser and Ebersol then approached Lorne Michaels. Over the next 3 weeks, they developed the idea for a variety show featuring high concept comedy sketches, political satire, and musical performances that would attract 18 to 34-year-old viewers.
Then they struck gold.
Yep.
Pretty sweet.
The show was originally called NBC's Saturday Night because Saturday Night Live was in use already.
Oh, it was?
By the show Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell on the rival network ABC. NBC purchased the rights to the name in 1976 and officially adopted the new title. On March 26, 1977.
Shh, we're not doing 76
oh,
and 77.
Oh, stop it. Sorry.
Don't tell those things.
Oh, I apologize. Anyway, it quickly developed a cult following. You ever heard of it?
Yep. A little bit.
Some people call it SNL.
Some people do.
And then Saturday, October 11th, that same day, Neil Sedaka takes over the number one spot on the Billboard charts with a terrible song, probably, because it's Neil Sedaka.
What is the song?
Bad Blood.
Bad Blood.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to play it.
No, I'm not going
to. You have to now.
I don't want to.
I don't remember it.
I don't either.
That's why you
gotta
play it.
In fact, I didn't even look this up or research. I must have missed it. Bad Blood, Neil Sedaka.
It's probably one that I'll go, oh, yeah.
No, I don't think you will. I think you'll be like, this is stupid and I hate it.
Really?
I don't know. Neil Sedaka, is he any good?
He's not good, but he's just, those songs are so from that era.
That doesn't mean anything.
Like, you hear that song and you're transported back.
There's a Taylor Swift song called Bad Blood.
We don't want to listen to that.
Maybe
right
Neil's.
Now.
Maybe,
this isn't the time to listen to that.
Maybe Taylor Swift remade Neil Sedaka's.
Maybe. Did you find it? It's so 70s. It's awful.
Blood.
Oh, it's awful.
I like it. I actually like it. I'm not joking at all.
You're
kidding. There's 2,500 thumbs up to that on YouTube and only 47 thumbs down.
Oh, that's
so,
I guess.
You're wrong and I'm right. That's a good song, actually. Holy shit. I think I love Neil Sedaka.
You're going to get a bumper sticker?
Yeah, and I got a boner already, so I might as well get a bumper sticker.
You get a tattoo on your butt cheek?
I'm going to get tattoos of Neil Sedaka. I'm going to buy all his albums. I'm going to not talk nonstop about Neil Sedaka to everyone. I'm so sorry. I assumed that was bad because that was a good song.
Neil Sedaka sucks.
No, you take that back.
Neil Sedaka sucks.
Our marriage is going to end because of this.
And he looks like, we already talked about him looking like somebody's uncle, but.
Yeah, but I strongly feel differently about Neil Sedaka now. I'm a strong supporter of Neil Sedaka.
You're a Neil Sedaka enthusiast.
I'm a Sedaka head.
All right, what's next?
I'm a Sedaka ass. Sedaka maniac. Terrible. All you Sedaka maniacs out there. Or Sedaka. Is it Sedaka or
Sedaka?
Sedaka. I should know that since I'm the biggest fan.
I know, you're number one fan.
Wednesday, October
22nd, of the fan club.
1975. The World Series of Major League Baseball wrapped up between the Boston Red Sox and the Cincinnati Reds.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2003, ESPN ranked it the greatest World Series, the second greatest World Series ever played. Cincinnati won the series in 7 games.
Okay.
Now, here's why it was so great. Oh, shit.
Just put that anywhere, pal.
Yeah, well, you know what? I do what I want. I'm really drunk. The Reds won the 7th and deciding game of the series on a 9th inning RBI single by Joe Morgan. You understand that? The 9th inning is usually the last.
I've already tuned out. I'm thinking about what I'm going to do tomorrow.
What are you going to do? Anything important?
I might, do my lesson plans.
Reds fans are going to be pissed at you, especially Dave Canisi. This is the sixth game of the series. The sixth game of the series was a 12-inning classic at Boston's Fenway Park. Well, there are many memorable moments from that game, among them by Red Sox pinch hitter Bernie Carbo hitting a game-tying home run in the 8th. Reds reliever Will McEnany pitching out of a bases loaded. No out jam in the bottom of the ninth. And Boston's Dwight Evans making a spectacular 11th inning catch to rob Joe Morgan of a go-ahead home run. This is remembered in Boston for the walk-off home run hit in the bottom of the 12th by Carlton Fisk.
God, I hope you cut that out. That was so
boring. Fisk's home run gave the Sox a 7-6 win to send the series to a deciding 7th game. You don't understand. The 7th game is like, that's the shit. Like, when it goes into 7 games, it's the big deal.
All right.
Anyway, the Big Red Machine won. That's the Reds. They call them the Big Red Machine. They won to clinch the first back-to-back World Series championships.
Okay.
You know who the MVP was? Pete Rose.
Oh, gambled yet.
No, you know him as a guy with giant nostrils who wrestles every year.
What year was it that he was gamble, that he got caught with the gambling? Was it in the 80s?
Yeah.
You don't remember what year? You blathered on and on about it. You wouldn't shut up about it, that episode. It was like your big boner for it.
I'm feeling
something.
Like our relationship's becoming contentious over baseball. Like, baseball's brought us to...
I'm a little angry that you went on and on so long about that story just now.
Well, if you go back to listen to our previous episodes, like last season, go ahead and if you're bored, true fans, true American Timelines fans, mm-hmm. go back and listen to all of our episodes to find out when Pete Rose was caught gambling, and then just tweet us.
Okay. Yeah.
Rather than just Googling it,
yeah.
Do that instead. That's probably smart.
That's the best way to go about it.
And then Friday, October 31st, that is my date of birth. I got to the party and I did the Smurf.
Okay.
I'm sorry. October 31st, 1975, mm-hmm. Halloween. when Queen wanted to release Bohemian Rhapsody,
yeah,
various executives suggested to them that at 5 minutes and 55 seconds, it's just way too long and would never be a hit.
Right.
And it was reportedly the most expensive single ever made at the time of its release.
Oh, well, wonder why.
Although the exact cost of production cannot be determined.
Huh.
And although critical reaction was initially mixed, Bohemian Rhapsody remains one of Queen's most popular songs and is frequently considered one of the greatest rock songs of all time.
Yeah, I could see that.
The single was accompanied by a promotional video, which many scholars consider groundbreaking.
Yeah, with their heads in the dark.
Rolling Stone stated that its influence cannot be overstated, practically inventing the music video 7 years before MTV went on the air.
That's true. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, everybody says the Buggles, but fuck the Buggles. Fuck the Buggles. Queen invented the rock video.
And who are the Buggles? That video killed the radio star?
Yeah, don't you remember?
I just didn't remember their name.
The 1981 episode.
I must have tuned out.
Oh, man. We'll have to go back and re-record that, probably.
Yep.
Anyway, there's a new movie about Freddie Mercury. It's called Mercury Mustache Queen.
That
show.
Is not what it's called.
Probably is.
You know, my mom always said, she said that if Freddie Mercury would have fixed his teeth, he would have been one of the handsomest men of that era.
Oh, but he's not because of his teeth?
Yeah.
So she's just basically picking him apart and saying he's unattractive.
Well, your teeth are like the single largest factor of your attractiveness.
My teeth?
Anybody's teeth.
Well,
I mean, imagine the most beautiful woman you can and then give her some fucked up teeth. And she's not at all pretty anymore.
Jewel's very pretty.
Jewel?
Remember, she never got her teeth fixed. Jewel?
Jewel.
Remember Jewel, the singer?
Kind of. What was
you
wrong?
You were meant for me.
What was wrong with her teeth?
What was meant for you? She had jagged, all jacked up teeth, I think.
What?
You're calling all British people unattractive? I don't know. I don't like where this
I'm
is just, going.
I'm telling you, your teeth are the single most important thing in your looks.
I don't think this is. This just seems shallow. Like, you just seem shallow to me.
It's the truth.
You don't like my teeth?
I wonder why Freddie Mercury never did get his teeth fixed.
Who gives a shit? He's too busy plowing dudes.
Yeah, I guess he was. Jeez.
What do you? Why? It was a defining factor about him. I think there's a lot of people once they get super famous, like David Letterman. He never got that gap fixed because he's David Letterman. And that's
the gaps
gap.
Are cool looking.
Oh, like the guy who played for the Giants, who has a talk show now.
I don't know who.
Harry Carson.
About.
No, Jumbo Elliott. No, Mark Bavaro. No, what's his name? The guy, Regis and Kelly, and then it's now the guy with a big gap in his teeth.
God, shut up.
Jeff Hostetler.
What are you talking about?
Michael Strahan. Boom, got it. Remembered it. Michael Strahan.
Move on.
Move on?
Yes.
You're the one who talks about everyone's teeth being terrible. Saturday, November 1st, 1975, Jack H. Hetherington, a physicist, had just finished writing a paper and was ready to publish that paper, but he realized that he had used we instead of I throughout his whole paper, despite him being the sole author.
Oh.
But he's too lazy to edit. He was like, I'm not going back and changing all that shit.
Oh, no.
He didn't have any way to change anything.
He didn't. Make up another name and put it on there.
No, he listed his cat, Chester, as a co-author.
Oh, my God.
The colleague to whom he had given his paper for review pointed out that he had used the first person plural in his text and that the journal would reject this form of submission with a sole author. Rather than take the time to retype the article to use a singular form or bring it to a co-author, he decided to invent one. And he used his cat.
And so it got printed?
Yep. And then they found out it was his cat, and they shot him.
I was going to say.
No, I don't remember what happened. I think years later they discovered that it was, but he made up a last name for the cat.
Fluffy Jones.
No, the cat's name was Chester. Chester A. Meow Meow, I think it was his name or something like that. Something crazy.
Chester A. Meow Meow.
Meow Meow.
And nobody was the wiser.
And that same day, Elton John took over the number one spot on the Billboard chart with Island Girl.
That one I do not know.
I don't either. I missed a whole bunch of these. You don't know Island Girl?
I do not.
And you claim to be an Elton John expert. That's the weird thing.
I do not.
No, you tell everyone. You had a jacket made with
embroider on the back, Elton John expert. And you wear it a lot.
That's a very nice.
It's bedazzled. It'd be jazz, the jazzle. She's 6'3".
I think it's about a drag queen.
Maybe. But that reminds me of, remember Kiki D?
Yeah.
Who do you think had the, I don't know, bigger career? Kiki D or Elton John?
Elton John?
Right. Let's November 5th, 1975. What happened?
On the evening of November 5th, 1975, a little after 6 p.m., seven hired woodcutters were making their way home to the town of Snowflake, Arizona, in the head of the group, Mike Rogers' pickup truck. As they chatted among themselves, the men suddenly noticed a strange glow coming from the woodland that hugged the side of the road.
What?
Thinking it was perhaps a forest fire, all the men were suddenly more attentive than they might have been, lest they become trapped in such a situation. As they approached the hill in the road where the light was coming from, they suddenly saw a large silver disc hovering over a clearing in the roads.
What?
It was glowing brightly, lighting up the patch of ground underneath it. Slightly in shock at what he was seeing, Rogers would bring the truck to a stop. As soon as he did so, and without warning, Travis Walton would leap out of the passenger side door and walked directly towards the strange glowing craft. This is the Fire in the Sky story.
Fire in the Sky. This is going to be my favorite. I love this story. But this is the same night that Beretta was on.
Oh, Beretta.
And another episode of That's My Mama, which we talked about briefly, but I don't think I alluded to the fact that That's My Mama starred Teresa Merritt, who is best known as the lady in Billy Madison, who says, "You want to stay home and help me shave my armpits?"
Okay.
It's that lady. She had her own show in 1974 and 5. And also on that night, if Travis Walton would have just went home to watch Doctor's Hospital instead, he would have never
Doctor's
been abducted
Hospital.
By aliens. It's the cases of Dr. Jake Goodwin, chief surgeon of a Los Angeles hospital, starring George Peppard.
Yeah.
And Zora Lampert.
Okay.
George Peppard was on that show. Doctor's Hospital.
Who's George Peppard?
Who's George Peppard?
Yeah.
He's Hannibal and goddamn A-Team.
Oh, okay.
Hannibal. I love it when a plan comes together.
All right.
Come
okay.
on. You're not excited?
So he's walking towards the craft.
Oh, God. Here we go. He's walking towards the craft.
Not hearing or not listening to the rest of the woodcutting crew who were pleading and demanding he return to the truck, Walton continued on until he was standing directly underneath the mystery object.
Now, he was like mesmerized, right?
Yeah.
He was just like, he couldn't control himself. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of like
Man, I love this story. This is the story. Before we get too far into this, just if you haven't heard this, I don't know what's wrong with you, but if you haven't heard this, you got to watch the movie and everything. This is the UFO story that makes me believe, like, the movie freaked me out. It wasn't even a real block, but it was like a TV movie or something, right?
No, it was a movie.
It was out in the theaters and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, I feel like I saw it on TV. It wasn't great actors or anything, but...
I think it was like Paul Rudd or something.
No, this was years ago before Paul Rudd was a thing.
It was like 93, I think.
No, it was that late? Anyway.
It was.
The movie, really, this is the one that makes me believe in UFOs. Like, this whole story... It's the most believable that I've ever heard, and this freaks me out, and I think it's real. This makes me think it's real.
Okay, so he continued on until he was standing directly underneath the mystery object. Then strange mechanical turbine-like noises began to fill the air. Yeah, at the same time, the craft began to wobble, still in its hovering position. Walton, perhaps now sensing something was about to happen, stepped back slightly and slowly began to back away.
Oh. So
then came the beam of blue-green light. The witnesses from...
Just like an E.T. You see this in E.T. E.T.'s real.
The witnesses from their vantage point from inside the truck witnessed a blue-green beam strike Walton square on the chest. This caused him to rise a foot into the air, his arms and legs outstretched, and shoot back stiffly some 10 feet. During this, Walton remained within the glow of the craft's light. Suddenly, he was seemingly flung to the ground like he touched a live wire, striking his shoulder upon landing. His body sprawled limply, apparently dead. That's certainly what the rest of the group initially thought as they sped away from the scene as quickly as they could.
They just left him there?
Yeah.
Oh, they didn't even care about him.
Well, they did. What exactly happened next and in what exact time frame varies slightly from account to account.
Yeah.
But it would appear that after initially fleeing the scene, the remaining six made the decision to return to the area in an attempt to retrieve their friend. However, upon doing so, he was no longer there.
You know what? I'm just going to say this right now. I don't care who you are or how close you are to me. I mean, loved ones, listen. Listen good. If we're out there in the woods and this starts happening to you and you get sucked up in the light, you gone. I'm gone. I ain't helping you.
You're not.
You
well,
did.
The guy
you
said,
I'm
I
out
watched
of here.
I watched an interview and the guy said it was just blind panic.
You would just panic.
We took off, and then
you
he said,
be
"After
able to think straight."
Then I started thinking and realized I need to go back and get him.
Not only
so
would
then
I,
they
yeah.
turned around and went back.
Not only would I yell and run and as fast as I could, I would shove my friends down and run over them.
George
fast,
Costanza,
like quick, like we're not my buddies and I. We used to in high school. We'd go out to the woods and we'd build a fort. And we'd go out there and drink beers and stuff and fight.
It's ridiculous.
And so. But if an alien would have come out there, I would have shoved those guys down into the fire and ran. I wouldn't care what happened to them.
Great.
I'm a great friend.
You are a good friend.
Yeah. That's
okay.
What I would do to everyone.
So, despite being sure they had the correct location, he was simply nowhere to be seen. More than unnerved and simmering towards panic, the men would drive to a shopping center in the nearby town of Heber. Again, while the exact time frame varies slightly, sometime between 7:30 and 8 p.m., Ken Peterson, on behalf of all six of them, phoned the local police.
Ken Peterson, he's a hero.
Although on the phone, Peterson stated merely that one of their crew had gone missing, the deputy agreed
to... between what times?
7:30 and 8.
Oh, okay. So just before Little House on the Prairie was going to start.
Oh, I remember when that was on. The deputy still agreed to meet them at their location. When he arrived, however, the men were all visibly distressed, some close to tears, tell them exactly what they had seen.
It's understandable.
Yeah, I would be
freaked
sobbing.
Out. I would definitely have pieces of poop in my pants.
Yes.
There would be pieces, full pieces.
There usually is, though, so it's not like that would be different from any other day.
That's true. There is a lot of pieces of poop in my pants. I just have a thing about, like, you know.
You just let it go.
I don't, you know, just... It's too hard to get up.
That's right.
And walk.
It was at this point, himself slightly overwhelmed with the strange nature of the apparent incident, that the deputy contacted his superior, Sheriff Marlon Gillespie. His orders were to ask the men to remain at the shopping center under his supervision until he could arrive.
Under Marlon Gillespie's supervision?
No, under the deputy's supervision.
Oh, Marlon Gillespie told the deputy to do this.
Yeah.
Because Marlon Gillespie, that's a guy who knows what to do.
So around 9 p.m., him and another police officer, Ken Copeland, pulled up at their police cars in Heber.
Ken Copeland, y'all.
By this time, several members of the crew, in particular Rogers, were becoming increasingly anxious.
Yeah.
Rogers would demand that a search was launched immediately and that they should return to the scene of the incident. Although they were not able to utilize any police search dogs, several officers, along with Rogers and everybody else, did examine the location. However, there was no sign of Walton.
They need a helicopter. That's what they need.
Yeah. And perhaps more importantly to their suspicions, there was no sign of anything as untoward as the crew were claiming it taken place.
So all these people just think they're nuts or something, or maybe they've gotten out of that cuckoo's nest.
The remaining crew members, in the meantime, would return to Snowflake and begin to inform family and friends of the bizarre situation. As the night wore on, the search would be delayed until morning. However, there was concern among the police that Walton, who was dressed only in jeans, shirt, and a light jacket, would fall victim to the brutal winter-like freezing conditions of the forest.
Yeah, because those Arizonians, they ain't used to the cold.
So by the following day, November 6th...
Oh, you mean the same night that... the Paul Lynde Comedy Hour was on?
Oh, yeah.
And the Streets of San Francisco was going to be on later?
Yep.
And Harry O?
What?
Harry O, you ever hear that?
No.
Starring David Jansen as Harry Orwell?
No, we don't need to go into it.
You know.
All right, by the following day, November 6th, with the sun bathing the area in full light, the region was searched once more. This time, many more people were part of the operation, including multiple volunteers.
Yeah.
However, once again, there was no sign whatsoever of Travis Walton.
All the nuts and wackos that believe in UFOs, probably, right?
Yep.
Like me?
Police, at least privately, suspected that the UFO story had been put in place to cover up an accident or even a homicide.
Ah, that's pretty good detective work. I would think the same thing. I'd be like, these guys are making up something because they killed their buddy.
Even though they were all, like, close to tears.
But they weren't covered in rum.
That's true.
But you'd be close to tears if you accidentally killed your buddy and didn't want anybody to know you killed him.
Well, it was only a matter of days before the incident leaked to the reporters, as well as UFO investigators with various degrees of genuineness. One of those UFO investigators hailed from Phoenix, Fred Sylvanus. Whether his intentions were well intended or not, the interviews he obtained with Michael Rogers and Walton's brother Dwayne would go on to be often used by skeptics. It perhaps didn't help that both men would openly and maybe correctly criticize the effort by the police in finding their colleague and brother. Dwayne would reveal that both he and his brother had a long-lasting interest in UFOs. In fact, Dwayne would even reveal he had witnessed a UFO himself 12 years previously. Furthermore, he would offer completely of his own accord that both he and Travis had made a pact that if either of them were ever to witness a UFO, they would get as close as possible. Some reports even claim they would try to get on board.
But Travis is the only one who actually followed through?
Well, they're just saying that they always had an interest in UFOs.
But you said they've seen them before.
That's what, yeah, but this is what skeptics would point to him saying this.
Mm-hmm.
As like, see, they're...
They've been talking about that stuff for a while. Yeah. They've been making up stuff.
Mm-hmm. So as the days went on following Walton's disappearance and several unsuccessful searches of the area where the crew had been working, suspicion began to increasingly return to the crew members. Due to the amount of time he'd been missing, combined with the below-freezing temperatures, the feeling among the police began to discreetly change from a search and rescue mission to one of recovering the young man's body.
Yeah, just recover the dead body, because this long, they're dead. They're always dead.
After the second full day of searching, the police would approach the crew members with an offer for them to take a lie detector test.
Yeah.
They had initially offered to take any kind of test in the hours following the disappearance in order to prove their account was truthful.
Well, there's no way lie detector tests were very reliable back then.
Well, and they all passed with no problem whatsoever, aside from one that didn't fail, but his results were inconclusive.
Because he swallowed the machine.
Yep. Then... On the night of November 10th.
What? More days?
More days. Sorry.
The evening of November 10th, 1975.
Yep.
The Kansas City Chiefs defeated the Dallas Cowboys 34-31 on Monday Night Football, while on CBS, Rhoda was on, All in the Family was on, and Maude.
Oh, wow.
And Maude bears her soul.
They were all by, I think they were all by the same guy, too, weren't they?
I don't know, but that's fucking must-see TV right there.
I know Maude and All in the Family were the same.
All in the Family and Maude.
That is must-see TV.
And there was a show called Medical Center that was on at 10.
Medical Center.
Yeah, starring James Daly and Chad Everett and Jane Meadows. You know any of those people?
I know. No, I know Audrey Meadows, but I don't know Jane Meadows.
Audrey Totter, you know who that is?
No. All right, so on
but
that
Rhoda was on.
On that night, well, Rhoda was on.
Yeah.
Walton's sister, Grant Neff, received a sudden phone call slightly after midnight on the evening of the 10th. So on the other end was Travis.
Who received this call?
His sister. Walton sounded confused, panicked, and disoriented. His sister managed to retrieve information that he was calling from an Exxon station somewhere nearby. Grant's husband and Walton's brother, Dwayne, would immediately jump in their vehicle and head towards where they found him crumpled to the floor of the phone booth at the gas station.
And he was naked, right? Was he naked?
No, he wasn't naked.
Oh, he wasn't?
No.
I'm naked right
you're
now.
Thinking of Terminator, the beginning of the Terminator movie. That's what you're thinking of.
No, I thought in the movie Fire in the Sky that he's naked when he gets back.
Well, that's Hollywood probably doing that. So
I'm naked right now talking about
years
this.
Later, Walton would recall his first memories of waking up following his 5-day disappearance. He would claim that he regained consciousness lying on his stomach with his head on his outstretched arm. He immediately noticed how cold the air was and was instantly awake. It was then that he noticed a bright light on the bottom of a curved gleaming hull. Then he noticed a mirrored outline of a silvery disc hovering somewhere over him. He would estimate the craft to have been about 40 feet in length. So how big is that, 40 feet?
It's 4 basketball hoops.
What?
Basketball hoop is 10 feet.
Oh, that doesn't,
lay it down.
That doesn't help me at all.
And 4 of those.
So it's not that big.
It's like from here.
It's not that much bigger than our airplanes and stuff. Or is it smaller than those?
40 feet is not that big. It's like...
I have no... I have no, like, spatial awareness.
It's like from here to the maybe the back door there, or like from...
That's 40 feet.
Yeah, maybe a semi-truck would be 40-foot truck.
So it is pretty small, then.
40-foot truck?
It's smaller than I would have thought.
Maybe not a big semi, because 40-foot, you can rent a 40-foot truck, right, from U-Haul?
I don't know. All right.
Let's Google what a 40-foot truck looks like.
So it moves silently above him for several moments. Suddenly, a warmth caressed the exposed skin of his body. Then the object shot vertically into the sky. In an instant, the craft was gone. Walton would later recall the most striking thing about its departure was how quiet it was.
It was a 40-foot truck.
Oh, okay. So that's pretty, that's kind of small.
Yeah.
After taking Walton to his mother's house, his brother Dwayne would take him to a hospital in Phoenix. And after some initial resistance, all involved would allow the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization to drive the case. They would immediately have Walton examined by two different physicians.
I wouldn't think that research organization isn't that prestigious in 1975.
Yeah, I know.
Because the only one that talked about aliens before this was Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
You know, they were so big in the 70s. Like,
I know.
Why aliens. Were they so prevalent in the 70s and then you don't hear about them anymore?
What, aliens?
Aliens, yeah.
I know. I don't know. It's,
they were all over the place then.
It was. It was. It seemed like a lot more than now.
Yeah, I wonder why.
So according to Walton, the last thing he clearly remembered was being struck by the beam of light as he stood underneath the glowing disc. The next thing he knew, he was lying on a flat surface like a reclined bed.
Yeah.
He immediately noticed that the air was damp and heavy. He also immediately felt pain all over his body.
Ouch. That would hurt.
Yeah.
Pain all over your body hurts.
Yes, it does.
Especially in your hemorrhoids.
A light shone down on him from above. Each breath was decidedly difficult and painful. He at first believed he was in a hospital somewhere. Then he noticed that three figures stood around him.
Here we go.
Each one had an orange suit, although it was perfectly obvious to Walton that they were not at all human.
Huh.
He would later state these figures were around 5 feet high, certainly no taller than that, and with strange bald and enormous heads.
So they all kind of look like... my neighbor Carl.
That's right.
He wears orange all the time, and he's a short, bald guy.
And their eyes were very large, and he described them as almost brown without much white in them, the eyes.
Huh,
the rest of their facial features were decidedly smaller than their size suggested. What Walton was ultimately describing was three gray aliens.
Oh, they are grays, huh? Though I would say, because the movie, Fire in the Sky, I don't think they're wearing orange suits. Maybe they are, but I'm going to have to go back and see it again. But I thought they were... Yeah. Nude. Of course, I thought everybody was nude.
So what he says what he did was he jumped down from the bed and he stood up and he started shouting at them, warning them to stay away. And he managed to pick up a glass-like cylinder from a shelf as he backed away. And he wanted to smash it and use it as a weapon, but
yeah.
he was unable to break it.
Huh.
So he just waved it at them and kept shouting.
Yeah.
Then they backed away and left the room.
Really? They left? It worked.
So then he also left the room. After
1 point for Walton.
He went down a hallway and soon found himself in a round room. He could see a strange chair with an overly large back to it sitting in the middle of the room.
Okay.
So he stepped forward, making his way toward the chair. As he moved inside the room, lights began to come on around him, and he cast his eyes around the intriguing and mysterious room, assuring himself he was still the only one inside. So then he moved forward, and he sat down in the chair, and then the lights came up, and then there was this...
And nobody's in there.
No. There was this, like, lever... on the chair
yeah.
that had this molded handle, and he would push the lever and the lights would come out and they'd go on, and then he realized he didn't know what these buttons were
what
doing.
What he was doing. He was probably controlling the whole craft.
Right, so then he freaked out and he left. Then he heard a noise from behind him, and he spun around and he saw a tall humanoid figure with a glassy helmet, and he was wearing blue coveralls.
What?
Walton began to fire questions at the man, but either he didn't hear or ignored him. So then he motioned for him that he should follow him.
It's Jimmy Hoffa.
So Walton did so, following the tall figure down another hallway. Then he went down a steep ramp and soon found himself in another large room, a room similar to an aircraft hangar. It was then that he realized the ramp. So it can't be that big, though. I mean, 40 feet, and then he got into a room that looked like an aircraft hangar.
Yeah, that all inside of that craft?
That's what I guess.
But maybe it's like dimensions, interdimensional.
It could be.
Things aren't the way they seem.
So then he saw two other discs landed in the hangar in front of him. Whether Walton was on board a mothership of some sort somewhere in Earth's orbit, or that's what the theory is.
So maybe the 40-foot one was a smaller one.
It took him to a mothership.
The mothership connection.
Or whether he was taken to a more terrestrial base somewhere on Earth is unclear. He was, however, led into another room where he claimed to see three humans, two men and a woman.
Wait, isn't Area 51 in Arizona somewhere?
Yeah.
There you go.
Unlike the person who led him here, these people had no helmets, although they too, as Walton could also see now, had a strange, larger appearance to their eyes.
Oh, but they were more human-like?
Yeah.
Like Mork, maybe it was Mork and Mindy.
Maybe.
Was one of them Mork?
No, I don't think so. Once more, he began to ask questions. However, much in the same way as the first humanoid, they dismissed his inquiries. They instead directed him to another table-like object, motioning that he should sit down. Before he realized what was happening, the woman approached him. In her hands, she had a mask-like device, and it was clasped to his face. Then he lost consciousness. And then the next memory he has is of waking up outside the gas station.
That's it, huh?
Yes.
But he saw other humans on there.
So many theories circulated that he may have been attacked and drugged, although in that he woke up in a hospital and then he got confused thinking he was on a spaceship because he was drugged. But then when they examined him...
hallucination.
Yeah. But then when they examined him, there were no signs of drugs in his system at all. And he didn't have any head injury or anything.
Hmm.
He did undergo hypnotic regression.
What's that?
It's like hypnosis.
Why is it called regression?
Because what you're trying to uncover past memories.
Gotcha. Hidden memories.
So what was interesting was that his conscious recall and unconscious memory were the same. Furthermore, he could access only the two-hour period following the beam of light hitting his chest.
Hmm.
And so that it seemed like there were memories that were off limits. Yeah. So they...
But you got to keep in mind, all the medical technology, the drug testing and everything is all 70s technology.
Right.
So who knows how good their drug testing was back then or how good their hypnotic progression skills were.
It's true.
You know?
But they're
limited.
They thought that there was indeed memories to unlock, but there was a purposeful mental block preventing access to them.
I mean, they didn't have Blu-rays even yet.
Walton would even state that if attempts to retrieve these memories continued, he would die. He would say.
Yeah.
So there were other details that very much supported his claims. He had a full 5 days worth of beard growth. He also appeared significantly malnourished. What is interesting, however, is that despite this very real physical evidence of prolonged period of starvation, there was also evidence to suggest that some form of basic nutrition was being given to him.
Ah, so the aliens had ensure shapes.
Something like that, yeah, because he didn't have like elevated levels of electrolytes in the blood, which
nothing like that. He was
normally
perfectly nourished.
Yeah.
So, are you hinting that aliens may have created protein shakes?
Yes.
Okay.
That's why I'm hinting it.
Okay.
So, with that in mind, whoever or whatever did take Walton from Arizona and wherever they took him, they were concerned, prepared, and aware enough to administer appropriate levels of fluid and nutrients to prevent any long-term damage to his health.
Well, if the aliens created all of us, then they knew how to do that.
True.
We're probably just their creation.
So, the other thing that is interesting is there were several sightings on November 10th, several hours before the apparent return of Walton.
No, there were. By other people?
Yeah.
Strangers?
Strangers.
Oh, let's hear these.
Although the location is unclear, there was a witness who reported seeing a V formation of orange lights over her house.
Oh.
She waited to see if the lights would return, then she blacked out, and her next memory was sitting in a large chair in a strange room with dim lights all around.
What? She was abducted too?
Yeah, that was one of the witnesses.
Holy shit, does she seem reliable?
That, I don't know much about her, unfortunately.
I don't know much, but I know I love her.
On the same night, a report came from Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, and according to that report, a bright star-like object about the size of a car was moving across the sky. There was no noise whatsoever with this. That's like a common thing.
Yeah, so they say with these alien ships, they often don't make noise, right? That's crazy.
Yeah, they don't make any noise.
Yeah, I'm scared.
And several sightings came from Canada in the early hours of November 11th
as well. Canadians don't know anything.
So Walton continues to speak about his experience to this day. He makes appearances at UFO conventions and takes interviews from different skeptics and believers.
Still? He's still alive?
Yep.
Oh.
His story became one of the seminal abduction stories after the movie Fire in the Sky was produced in 1993.
Seminal. Maybe we should have him as a guest on our podcast.
Travis Walton?
Yeah, and see what he thinks about Neil Sedaka.
Because we're doing some hard-hitting, yeah. We do some hard-hitting topics over here. We do. Timelines.
What do you think about Neil Sedaka?
I know that you.
I know you're abducted by an alien, but first, Neil Sedaka, good or
what
shitty?
Do you think?
What do you think?
Good or bad? Thumb up, thumb down.
That was awesome. I love that story. That's a great one, and you wrapped it up pretty good and concise and
thanks,
quick,
babe.
And if you haven't seen that movie, you should see it. It's really freaky, and I think this is true. This makes me believe in aliens. Friday, November 7th, 1975, Wonder Woman debuted on ABC. And little girls everywhere were vindicated forever, and there's no more inequality.
Oh,
inequality
I should have done. I wish I would have done this story.
Take that, Me Too movement.
Oh, Wonder Woman was the best. You know we own the first three seasons on DVD.
I know you won't shut up about it. That's how I know.
And
I
bought
up.
It. I bought it when Audrey was like five.
That's our daughter.
And I thought, oh, she'll love this.
But
and
it was boring as shit.
Yeah, it was so boring.
It's
and
boring.
It, like,
just like Hulk.
It
Hulk
was like
really
it was like when you watch porn and you fast forward.
Wait, what?
To get to the good part.
You what? Who
you
does
had to
that?
Like fast forward through all the exposition to get to the part where
you
she
need
turns
the story
into Wonder
for porn.
Woman.
I mean, you gotta have the story.
But yeah, we just would fast forward to get to the part. Oh, she turned into Wonder Woman.
Wait, you're not showing our kids porn, are you?
No.
Okay. Good.
It was a metaphor, babe. It was a.
Oh. Good, because you shouldn't. But both the Hulk and Wonder Woman are both so boring with exposition that it's not. You just want to see the action.
Yeah, that's right.
And nowadays, I don't think they. That's why they start action movies like with a big explosion and a kill right away.
Yeah.
Because they don't have all that boring.
They realize.
Bill Bixby
it.
Walking on a beach for 15 minutes with sad music playing.
Yeah.
And then Sunday, November 9th. 1975, the NWA United States Championship Tournament was a tournament that took place.
Wait a minute, you didn't look up anything about Wonder Woman?
No, it just debuted on ABC.
Oh, you fucker.
It was a TV show.
Yeah, I just, that's, you know how important it is in my life. Like, you know me and Wonder Woman.
Oh, I just, no, this year I just sprinkled in a couple debut shows. That's all. That's why earlier I talked about,
but
you
should
Welcome Back Cotter.
I didn't know, and it would have been a present to me.
Anyway, the NWA United States Championship Tournament was a tournament that took place on November 9th, 1975, and was created to crown a new United States champion after Johnny Valentine suffered a career-ending back injury. That's Greg the Hammer Valentine's father. Terry Funk defeated Paul Jones.
Can't wait
Paul
till the
Jones.
60s when I don't have to sit through this shit anymore.
Shh. Terry Funk defeated Paul Jones in the finals to win the championship. And then here are the eight men in the tournament. See if you recognize these from other wrestling stories we've had in the past.
Okay.
This is in the 70s, 75. Rufus R. Jones, Blackjack Mulligan, Dusty Rhodes, Wahoo McDaniel, Harley Race, and Johnny Weaver.
Yeah, I remember.
In addition to Paul Jones and Terry Funk. Remember all those? The King Harley Race.
Some of them.
Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, baby. The American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, baby. And then Wednesday, November 19th, 1975,
mm-hmm.
Blackjack Mulligan. Changed his shoes.
No.
From now on, this is a Blackjack Mulligan podcast.
No, it's not.
It's just going to be about all Blackjack Mulligan.
All right.
Wednesday, November 19th, only three films have won all of the big five Academy Awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Writing.
Godfather?
Those films were It Happened One Night, 1934.
Mm-hmm.
The Silence of the Lambs, 1991.
Yes.
And this movie, 1975.
And it wasn't Godfather.
Nope.
Part two or whatever.
Nope.
Trying to remember the movies from 1974.
I'll tell you some other things about this movie.
Okay.
Many of the extras were actual authentic mental patients.
Oh, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Correct.
That's such a good movie.
During filming, a crew member running cables left a second-story window open at the Oregon State Mental Hospital, and an actual patient climbed through the bars and fell to the ground, injuring himself.
Oh, God. I thought you were going to say he died.
Nope. The next day, the Statesman Journal in Salem, Oregon, reported the incident with the headline on the front page,
one flew out of the cuckoo's nest. Louise Fletcher was so upset with the fact that the other cast members could laugh and be happy while she had to be so cold and heartless that near the end of the production, she removed her dress and stood in only her panties to prove to the cast members she was not a cold-hearted monster.
Oh, wow. Like, without a bra on?
Yeah, it seems like there's other ways you could prove that.
Yeah, I know.
Other than just getting naked.
I mean, it seems like a weird way to want to prove that. It seems like kind of...
Yeah, it seems like might be some... daddy issues, maybe.
Might be something else going on.
Something else going on there.
Like, how does that prove that you're not a cold-hearted bitch?
I don't know. Maybe you should prove it, because...
I don't think I need to prove
it. You should prove
anything.
It right now.
I don't need to prove anything.
There's only one way to prove it, baby.
I think you should do that next time you're at work.
Yeah, I'm going to... I do feel the need to prove to my coworkers that I'm not a cold-hearted bitch, so I think I might just...
You should.
Just wear my panties to work from now on. It freaks me out.
Scares me. Yeah.
And then Saturday, November 22nd, 1975, KC and the Sunshine Band, That's the Way.
I like it.
That's the Way. I like it. That's a great song. And then on November 29th, that's taken over by Silver Convention.
Silver Convention?
Fly, Robin, Fly. You ever
fly,
heard of
Robin, Fly, up to the sky.
Do you like that song?
Yes.
I don't think I remember that song.
It's like a disco.
Oh, that's why.
It's a total disco song.
No, I just don't really care for disco much. Then Monday, December 1st, 1975, Kodak invented the first digital camera.
Digital? In 1975?
Yep.
Really?
They didn't patent it until 1977. But instead of marketing it, they focused on their film business. Hashtag bad move. But if you look up this camera,
mm-hmm.
It's crazy looking. It looks like
50
fake.
Pounds.
It is the Kodak's Steve Sasson has come up with a brand new alternative to film, dubbed the film-less photography. The prototype camera records images and plays them back on a television set. So it looks like this giant machine that's part Super 8 movie camera, part audio cassette tape, and part TV.
Oh.
I'm going to show you the picture.
The TV's in it?
Google this picture. Google 1975 digital camera. Everyone, Google along with me and hit image. Click on the image searches.
Oh, it was weird looking.
See that thing? It's like a camera with a tape. It looks like a tape. Cassette tape taped to it, all this crap down here, and
how does it even work?
It projects the projector thing that takes it.
It's huge.
Your picture gets imprinted on that film on the cassette.
Oh, that's so weird.
It records the images on the cassette tape, and then
how can you record images
on
a cassette tape?
I don't know. He hacked together the camera from spare parts, the lenses from a Super 8 movie camera. The image is captured by a CCD, a charge-coupled device, an array of capacitors which convert light into an electrical signal, and the resulting image is recorded onto a cassette tape. The whole thing is powered by 16 nickel-cadmium batteries.
16 batteries. That's what was you could see in the bottom of it.
Yeah, the portable electronic still camera takes 23 seconds.
16 batteries.
Takes 23 seconds to record a 100-line image to tape. To view the picture, you pop out the cassette and slip it into the custom-built playback device.
God, what a pain in the ass.
This uses another cassette player and a frame store to boost the image to 400 lines and outputs a standard NTSC signal for use on any television. Can you imagine using that crazy thing and seeing a picture on your TV? That would blow your mind.
It would, but it'd also be a pain in the ass.
It'd be a pain in the ass. But, they were inventing it. They were just figuring it out.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
And then on Tuesday, December 16th, One Day at a Time debuted on CBS.
One day at a time.
Schneider looked like he smelled like cigarettes.
Oh, yeah, he did.
Coffee. It smelled terrible. And B.O.
Yep.
Schneider.
Cigarettes, coffee, and chewing gum.
And then Tuesday, December 23rd, 1975, the Metric Conversion Act is an act. The Metric Conversion Act was passed by Congress that U.S. President Gerald Ford signed into law on December 23rd, 1975, declaring the metric system the preferred system of weights and measures for United States trade and commerce.
Wait a minute. Then what happened? Didn't catch on.
Everybody just ignored it.
Really?
Yeah. They try to go to the metric system.
Well, it doesn't. It makes sense. I mean, because we're the only country in the entire world that doesn't use the metric system. And the metric system is based on 10.
It declared it the preferred system, but it permitted the use of United States customary units in all activities. So everybody just ignored that.
Well, I never understood why we don't have the metric system. It's so much easier.
Stop yelling at me. I didn't choose that. It's not me.
I'm not yelling at you.
You are. Stop throwing things at me. Stop. Stop. You just threw a stapler at me.
I got some toys.
You do?
Yeah, I got. First of all, the pet rock.
I got one more thing on Christmas, but you go and do your toys.
Don't say stupid. Because you said that one time. Well, the pet rock was that fad blew up in the middle of 1975.
Yeah, that's the biggest scam ever.
I know, googly eyes glued to a rock is all it was. By Christmas, despite solid sales, the trend was essentially dying.
Sometimes I put googly eyes on my wiener.
Not that inventor Gary Dahl was likely upset. He had sold over a million stones for $4 a pop by that point.
Man.
And then, hold on.
No, I realized why I kept thinking everyone was naked in that Walton story.
What? Oh.
Why? I kept getting wrong about him being naked.
I thought you were talking about the Waltons. The show.
No, wasn't his name Sam Walton?
Travis Walton. Travis Walton. But when you said that, I thought you were talking about naked and the Waltons.
The naked Waltons. Yeah, I watched a porno about the Waltons.
Oh, my God. All right. So why did you think he was naked? You just said you realized it.
Yeah, because I watched a porno and I was getting confused with porno. No, I'm just kidding. I don't watch pornos. I think they're wrong, in fact.
Okay, the first toy is called the Matchbox Steer and Go Car Set.
Wow.
Is a steer and go car set battery powered, turn on key ignition, shift transmission into either forward or reverse. Racing type steering wheel maneuvers car around hairpin turns, over bridges, and along straight.
Oh, is that like a?
It's like a. It looks like you're driving a car. Like it's like
but
a
it's
little
just
dashboard.
A little thing, a little dashboard. Yeah. Yep. And it's a little screen.
And then
a little tiny.
And then there's this like circle thing in front of it where the car goes around it.
Let me see. Oh. Oh, okay. No, that's not what I was thinking of. Yeah, I never had that.
It looks like it'd be pretty awesome.
Probably stupid.
You don't think?
No, I don't know. Kids are stupid. Sorry.
Then, of course, there was the children's record player.
Oh, everybody had a children's record player.
Compact portable phonograph with 3-inch speaker. Comes in rugged red molded plastic cabinet. Plays all 33 and a half and 45s.
Yep, and you have that little thing that
comes with a built-in 45 adapter.
Yeah, the little adapter you put in the middle.
Mr. Potato Head, take him apart and put him together. Ideal children's toy for fun games.
Don't get that stuck up your butt.
What kind of games do you play with Mr. Potato Head?
I don't. Mr. Potato Head was always a waste. Like, once you put the stuff on his head, then what do you do?
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
You take him off, start all over?
Yep. Then there was the Bert and Ernie dolls from Sesame Street.
Oh, I remember Bert and Ernie.
They were like stuffed animals.
America's only gay Muppets.
The Starship Enterprise model. Replica Starship Enterprise flight deck includes sick bay, captain's chair, and computer console.
You gotta have the sick bay.
Transporter room, Star Trek figures sold separately
for
$288.
Where does Spock go when he has explosive diarrhea?
Oh, I know. That's always the question I've had in my head.
Spock diarrhea, y'all.
There's a Barbie VW camper.
Yeah.
Gotta love that.
I don't care about that.
They go to the mountains or camp on the beach in comfort. This custom bus is shaped like the VW van with sliding doors and removable sunroof. Includes table and camper stool, ice chest, lantern, pickaxe, shovel. What is she gonna do? My God, she's got a pickaxe and a shovel.
I don't know, but I feel like I'd rather have that pickaxe up my toenails right now than listen to this.
You know what?
Sorry.
And then Pong TV game. Pong
oh,
TV
there we go.
Table tennis game with action and sound using the twist knob to move the paddle up and down the screen. Works with any color black and white TV by connecting through the antenna socket, offering fast-paced action game you can play on your TV.
You have redeemed yourself.
So,
everyone loved Pong.
You know what?
Well, and also...
And the Barbie camper. Let me tell you a little bit more about that.
Oh, God.
But I'm wondering why Barbie's got all those... That murder kit in her VW camper.
Well,
she's got shovel and a pickaxe and some duct tape.
Murder. That's why. Maybe that's why
you're a murder kit in her camper.
That's probably why ladies are more obsessed with
girls your age, women your age, love murder.
Why?
They're obsessed with these murder shows and true crime.
Because Barbie had a murder kit. Because
they grew
in her
up
camper?
With a murder kit. With their, they played murder with Barbie.
Yep.
That's why all these women love the true crime podcasts.
You figured it out.
But that same day that everyone was getting that murder Barbie set, bank robber John Wojciechowicz plotted some of his robbery based. Bank robber John Wojciechowicz plotted some of his robbery based on scenes in the movie that came out this day, The Godfather, starring Al Pacino.
Oh, he planned it around stuff that happened on The Godfather? Like he tried to...
Oh, wait a minute. Okay, sorry. Thursday, December 25th, 1975, Dog Day Afternoon came out.
Yes.
The movie Dog Day Afternoon?
Yes.
And so this was Al Pacino playing a bank robber. You know, doing a bank robbery, and it's where he yelled, Attica, Attica!
Yeah.
And that's where that kind of became a thing. But that was all improvised.
He didn't yell, Attica, Attica. He yelled, Attica, Attica.
Oh, yeah. He started chanting it, and that was improvised when he did that.
Oh, really?
But this was based on a true story. And here's the funny thing is
That's right, it is.
It's based on an actual bank robber named John Wojciechowicz, who actually... The real bank robber plotted his robbery based on scenes in The Godfather starring Al Pacino.
Oh, you're kidding.
And Al Pacino played him. How cool is that? And weird.
That is weird.
Okay, let's see. Although he had initially agreed to play the part of Sonny, Al Pacino told Sidney Lumet near the start of the production that he couldn't play it. Pacino had just completed production on The Godfather Part 2, and he was physically exhausted and depressed after the shoot. With his reliance on the method, he's a method actor, so he has to go crazy into everything.
Yeah.
Pacino didn't relish the thought of working himself up to a state of near hysteria every day. Lumet unhappily accepted the actor's decision to dispatch the script to Dustin Hoffman, but Pacino changed his mind when he heard that his rival was being considered.
Oh, were they rivals?
Yeah, he hated Dustin Hoffman's guts, probably. During production, Al Pacino reportedly only slept a couple hours a night, ate sparingly, and would sometimes take cold showers. This was in order to emphasize Sonny's disheveled, exhausted, and yet wired appearance.
Jesus.
And in the
you ever heard of acting?
Yeah, I know. Just act. The real robbers got $213,000 in the robbery.
Did they really?
Yeah. So how about that? You didn't know
how
that.
How about that?
And then to end the year, to end this episode, and to end 1975, the Staple Singers take over the number one spot on the Billboard chart to end the year.
Yeah, with...
Let's do it again.
Let's do it again.
Let's do it again.
I don't know that.
You don't know it? It's great. Well, I'm going to play it.
Is it really great or are you just
singing? I think it's great.
You do?
Yeah, Staple Singers are great. I like this song. I just can't, since I can't sing.
I can't tell what the hell it is.
Yeah, I do it in the morning.
I'll probably know it once
Let's do it again. Let's do it in the morning.
All right, stop. Not you got to stop singing it. Yeah, that's a pretty good song. This is a sexy song. You know what they're talking about, don't you? Doing their taxes.
Cleaning out your nostrils?
Yep.
Yeah, this is a sexy song. This is a great song. I love that song. So that's it. And then 1975 was over. That's
it. Oh, my God. And then should all acquaintance be forgot?
It's New Year's.
Yeah.
That's the first time that was saying New Year's Eve.
No, but I'm just trying to get in the spirit of the end of 1975.
The end of 1975.
Everybody's passing around a doob.
Yep. And this has been episode 42.
Don't Bogart.
Anyway, did you like this? Do you think this is good?
I did think
1975 was a good year.
I did think, I thought you did a very good job.
You did?
Yeah, you did a very nice job.
Me?
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Even though I have poop in my pants?
It was passable.
I have pieces of poop in my pants?
Yes, even though that.
And I'm nude?
Wait, how can you have poop in your pants if you're nude?
Well, my pants are over there on the counter.
With poop on them?
They're over on the sink.
Gross, you're soaking them. All right.
Yeah.
You know what? Chuck Berry just walked in. Thanks, Queen City Podcast Network.
Queen City Podcast Network.
Is going to love this.
They still haven't kicked us out of the network for some reason. They're letting us stay.
All right.
I think it's because of our affiliation with the great Matt Truman Ego Trip, baby.
Yes. And be sure to rate, review, subscribe, all that shit.
Yeah, give us. So when we say that means actually do it. Don't just like, oh, yeah, whatever. Like, go on iTunes and do it, okay?
Do it again.
Do it again.
If you already did it,
do it again. Make up fake names and do it again. Do it again and call your neighbor. Go to your neighbor's house and break in their house and shake them and tell them to get on their iPhone and listen to American Timelines.
That's right, damn it. All right, here comes Chuck Berry. Damn it.
Oh, crap. He's got my pants.
Get out of here.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.